Oh, that's a big, I'm very glad you asked it. You asked two questions, really. The first one, it's one of those questions that is sort of easy but impossible at the same time. It's easy because, yes, there's always more to it. There always is some reality. I mean, everybody has an identity, and the collective identity can be put together, and there's no reason why you said, well, we're entitled to our place under the sun. It's just that that has to stand the test of reason and justice and so on. In my view, the Zionist notion doesn't. The chapter, I describe it in this book, the second chapter is titled The Unnatural History of a Bad Idea. It's a bad idea, you know, it's a mistake. Now, the economic part is very important. Because what I hadn't mentioned is for reasons of time, but which is essential, so I'm so glad you brought it in, but I'll just do a brief discussion, is that although the Zionists wanted to get out of Europe, they also, A, considered themselves fundamentally European, B, needed money from European capitalists to do the job, and C, knew that they would have to have the aid of a Western imperial power of some sort. Theodor Herzl, who was the founder of all this, spent a lot of time, really wore himself out, died young, traveling around, speaking to wealthy people. He tried to get the Ottomans, Turkey, to support them, and that was a non-starter. It wasn't going to happen. But he eventually got the British, and he didn't, but I mean the Zionists did, because he died in 1906, I think, or whatever. It wasn't until 1917 that the Zionists were able to get Britain to sign a board. And that was very momentous, the Balfour Declaration. It led to a great deal of trouble because Britain could never do this in an honest or open way since they had to play all the imperial cards at once. But it made the crucial difference because it gave the Zionists the support of a big Western power. And giving them support of a big Western power also enabled them to now start integrating themselves into the circuits, not start, but continue and fulfill the integration of themselves into the circuits of the Western economic system, which is capitalism. And so, therefore, you really cannot and should not study the history of the State of Israel without studying its never-ending and intricate relations with the world capitalist system and the major capitalist powers, which, of course, is us at this point. And now you enter into the very, very large and interesting and intricate subject that what is the relationship of Israel to global capital, to U.S. capitalism, to U.S. imperialism? That's a big book in itself. There's a good book written on it by John Bichler and Nitzan, The Political Economy of Israel, a 2002 book. That's it, Bichler and Nitzan, who are Israelis economists. Really should read it, called The Political Economy of Israel. It details the very interesting relationships of big-time capital and Israel, mainly finance capital. Israel started out as a simulacrum of the peasant society, and although certainly in the cases of the kibbutzim, whatever their problematic side, they were productive and they made surplus products and sold some of it on the market, whether it's shoes or oranges or the like, but that was like petty commodity production. What changed Israel, and it changed enormously because in the first couple of years after the founding of the Israeli state, it had the greatest level of equality, economic equality of any country of a Western sort. But now, 60 years later, it has the greatest amount of inequality. And what happened in the interim was the development of Israeli capital away from this petty commodity, sort of localized agricultural based thing. One reason being that the whole land was becoming so polluted and wrecked that they couldn't make anything out of it anyhow. But more importantly, because the major economic interest gradually, and not so gradually, but precipitously, came over and joined up with the military-industrial complex of it at an international level. So that's one thing. Israel has very, very elaborate and intricate relations with weapons industries. They make some things themselves. More importantly, they make components to jet planes. And if you can trace back and forth how the Israeli military gets its stuff from the United States, you're a wizard. It's all this shadow stuff, and indeed shadow stuff. Israel has, and the other side of it is finance capital. Israel is a country that has no laws prohibiting money laundering. It is a free fire zone for all kinds of financial manipulations and the like. And so you have to deal with that. And then, of course, there's another major element, which is Russian capitalists who have come into Israel and invested very heavily in it. Now, about 10% of Israel is Russian-born. Russian is now the second language of Israel, more than English. And so it is. And a lot of these people are coming down from Russia with, you know, various kinds of capitalist games on hand. So what you have is still a kind of a casino economy, rather dependent economy. I don't think it would exist absent its propping up by the United States and big, global capital. But it's a real player in the world system and has to be taken as such.
What is the role then of the right of return of the Palestinians?
Okay, but just a little addendum about the two addenda. One is about the Ottomans and selling absentee landlords, but there was a law was passed. I forget at what level, but anyhow, it was a law that under such circumstances, and prior to this law, even though the land changed hands, the peasants had a right to stay there. But when the Zionists bought it, it was under the condition that now they owned it and could expel the peasants, the fellaheen, and that's indeed what happened, and that's sort of the roots of the hatred that grew up on the part of the Arabs. It goes way back to the 1880s. The other thing is about the Israeli Supreme Court is a real joke, and it's the idea. And that's the problem with Israel. It's not a society that has a foundation in law. It's a society that has a foundation in divine privilege, and entitlement. In 1980, the Israeli Supreme Court held that it was illegal for any settlement to be built, any Jewish, on land that had been privately owned by Palestinians. They said, you cannot expropriate. This is in the West Bank. Well, la-di-da, that is not worth the paper it was written on. I mean, you can imagine in the United States, when the United States Supreme Court says something, people say, well, yes. Of course. I mean, you may hate it, you can quarrel with it, all kinds of things, but that's the Supreme Court. That doesn't carry any. There's no weight. There's no real weight. So, yes, they said about the roadway, and now they'll just become drawn into the power structure of the existing Zionist configuration. I think that the right of return is absolutely essential. I devote a fair number of pages in the last chapter of the book. Since 1951, the right of Jewish return has been established, so that anybody in this room who had a Jewish mother or grandmother is enabled to go back and, filling out a few forms, become a citizen of the State of Israel. I mean, in my case, I don't know. They may make an exception, but legally I'm entitled, but they don't have anything to worry about on that account. But of course, the right of the return of the indigenous people is merely recorded in the United Nations and in principles of international law. But what does that matter? Well, it has to be made to matter. There is a resolution, I think it's 194 before the United Nations. It's been there since just after the 67 war, maybe the early 70s. In any event, it's been continually there and continually violated. But what's happened is around that, has grown up a very impressive group of NGOs and various kinds of popular movements dedicated to it. And there's really a lot there on the ground, so to speak, that will press very hard for it. I have a friend who runs an organization called COR, COHR, Committee on Housing Rights and Equality, and Scott Leckie. And he's a U.S. attorney who lives in Thailand. He spoke before Zokrad, actually, and they have it worked out. The international right of return people have it worked out, so they have already predicted that in 90% of the cases there shouldn't be much difficulty in actually adjudicating it, in part because of an irony in that the Jewish state, since it can't be made to seem ostensibly, racist and has this shell game where all the land is owned collectively by the Jewish National Fund, and then it sells only or leases only to Jews, and technically Jews don't really own the land, only the Jewish National. But by the same token, they have excellent records. And they really, you know, it's like they have a national directory of all the properties. And in the case of the Palestinians who've been displaced, you know, even the house keys are still, you know, kept on file. There's a lot of, you know, good book. So it's remarkably simple from an administrative standpoint to put this into effect. Obviously, it's anything but simple from a political standpoint. But the thing is, considering how much is wasted on the wars and how much terrible, you know, effects are being wrought every day by this horrible situation of violation of human rights, the kind of things that are necessary to adjudicate some kind of right of return are quite feasible and have been elaborately worked out by more than one, you know, Geneva-based or Paris-based or Brussels-based or Thailand, you know, Bangkok-based, whatever. There's a big international network that cares about this. So it can be done. And of course, once it's done, once you even get the principle accepted, well, then the Jewish state is a thing of the past. And it may very well be that that's the way it can be done, by working out the right of return. Because once that happens, the Jewish state loses its demographic majority, which is part of the impulse to ethnically cleanse stems from the fact that there are so many more Arabs around there than the Jews, that they have to keep clearing out the Arabs so they can have a demographic majority so they can still call themselves the only democracy in the Middle East. But, you know, you can't sustain that forever. It's basically an unsustainable relationship. And the right of return implemented can be, so to speak, the midwife of that change. And it could be a way in which it would happen peacefully. And it's certainly something for all people of goodwill to attend to. I'm just not sure I heard you. Considering that Hamas has been dismissed?
Considering that they've been dismissed.
Oh, yeah, okay. I got it now. Well, as you know, Hamas, or should know, Hamas has been on record now for a number of years of asking for a long-range ceasefire with Israel, something that would last for 13 or 15 years. That's scarcely the language of somebody who wants to see Israel destroyed. If you get a ceasefire of that sort, it creates space or time during which a lot of other things can happen. I mean, it's hard to say what's the most demonized entity in the world today, but certainly Hamas is in the top five. And if you look very closely at Hamas, it's not anything that I would be particularly thrilled about, because it is based on an Islamic ideology and it has a history of resorting to violence. But, you know, if you come right down to it, as Shlomo San said, you know, if I were a Palestinian, I would react this way. And Ben Gurion said the same thing, and Moshe Dayan said the same thing. That all these Zionist leaders who had any honesty said, well, you know, I understand why they're angry at us. We're taking their land, so they're going to get violent. Hamas has won its spurs, so to speak, for two reasons. One is, it unlike Fatah or the PLO, it is relatively incorruptible and steadfast, and won't take any, you know, crap from Israel. And the other is that it provides a lot of honest social services to the people. None of this, to me, strikes me as being, you know, like the level of Pol Pot and the Taliban. You know, Hamas is not like that. So they're mostly very sophisticated intellectuals who just are very firm in their belief. And I think it's time to stop demonizing them. And I quite agree with tenor of your remarks that they should be given, they certainly should be put on the table as the authentic, democratically elected representatives of the Palestinian people. And then we should start taking very seriously what they're saying. What they're asking for basically is a sustained ceasefire, which is a terrific opportunity to make some interesting, over a period of time, that can grow into all kinds of organic relationships. No, that shouldn't be shocking. That's part of the stipulated, that's the rules of the game. Not everybody has the right of return, would exercise the right of return, but everybody should be recognized as having, you know, had some injury done to them, and there should be restitution. But the key thing is it has to be done on a case-by-case basis with dialogue, you know, and One option could be a cash return. I mean, there are a lot of Palestinians who have made very good lives for themselves. And they're very highly educated, sophisticated people, professionals and all. They don't necessarily want to return, but they need some kind of recognition for what they've been through. So no, it's not so bad. And I want to say something about preaching to the choir. You may not like religion and all that. I have mixed feelings about it. But you know, religions have had a very powerful role in human history, and sometimes not always for the worst. You know, there's been some interesting developments. And they required preaching to the choir for doing that. That is to say, the congregation. You know, people, you can't just get a flyer and that's it. You know, you have to kind of reflect, you have to have dialogue, it has to be digested, broadened, connected, you know? And so there's nothing wrong with that. One should speak before every possible audience, so long as there's conditions for discourse. I mean, if people are going to start screaming, as has happened to me, you know, and assaulting the stage, well, you know, there are limits to that. But you take everything, and there's nothing wrong with talking to a people who have moved into your sphere. If you can deepen the relationships, if you can deepen the understandings, you know, move us forward that way.
But my question is, looking at the land that would encompass a one-state solution, and given that Israel now appropriates a hugely disproportionate amount of natural resources and economic resources for its citizens, what would be the impetus for them to agree to a one-state solution?
Good question, and there's no need answer to any of this. The one state, I think of the one state solution in several ways. One of them is I call it a strategic goal. That is to say, it's like a lodestar, the star you navigate by, and you navigate by it because it's the end, and the means to the end are along the same path, which is universal human right. And whereas a two-state solution is not grounded in universal human right, and therefore is not a clear, morally and politically coherent path. So that is inalienable. That's bedrock. Then the question is, what is the practicable notion there? What kinds of intermediate formations? What kinds of larger bodies can be drawn in? For instance, I mean, to me it seems probably necessary, given the bitterness and the terrible things that have happened, that there has to be some kind of agreement amongst larger powers to sort of facilitate this, to have a protectorate, for instance, you know, create an open space. That's just my idea. And I emphasize that not just out of being nice. I think that ultimately the key thing here is it has to come from the people on the ground. Now, why would the Israelis want it? Why does this fellow Shlomo Zand want it? He wants it because he realizes he's sick and tired of living in an ethnic state where everything turns to dust, where everything is ruined, where life is ugly and built on racism. I mean, to live in a racist society is very, very demoralizing. He wants to live in a non-racist society. I mean, the guy doesn't have to be a flaming radical to do that. He just has to be a decent human being. He wants to see his children raised in such a society. He wants to see his children raised in a society where they can relate to, Arab, Palestinian, Christian children the same way they relate to everybody else. That to me would be sufficient. Now, it would be anti-Semitic for me to deny that Israelis could do that. I think Israelis are a great mixture of things. You get a very bad formation like that, and it induces a lot of bad things in people. But there's also a residue of disgust and yearning to get beyond that, and yet perplexity. So, and yet people are also afraid to even think certain stuff because they'll be ostracized, they'll be put down. So gradually, if you can begin to open up this kind of discourse, people will be allowed to hope to frame in their minds a better world for themselves and more importantly, for their children. And that's sufficient. Israel is a wretched country. I can't say it strongly enough. The only joys it has are conquest, power, militarism, and those are not authentic human needs, you know, and people are getting tired of it. Not necessarily, because there are a lot of brutal people there, but, you know, this is, you have a long, hard road ahead, but it's, you know, it's a road that you can foresee.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you're touching upon a very important point. I think that this really goes further in the direction of what I was suggesting in the last questioner, namely that matter has to be developed at a level of not just the internal politics, but also the power relationships in the region. And a larger and better way of looking at that is that it seems to me, and really, I'm so glad we brought this up because it's probably time to stop soon, but this is, in a way, the most important thing of all, is what can this country, the United States, be made to do? You know what I mean? That they say that this, if there's one country who an enlightened policy from which would make a big difference, it's this country right here. And, if the Iran policy of the United States could be, you know, put on a rational basis, that would have a big effect down the line. One thing I'm fairly certain of, there's never been when was the last time Iran invaded any country, you know? Emperor Darius, you know, Thermopylae, I mean, Troy? Well, that's even further back. I mean, and my son-in-law is Iranian. You know, I know a bit about it. They're not a belligerent people. They're not nice. It's a terrible theocracy, but also a theocracy that rests on sand. I mean, you know, the younger people in Iran are fed up. That theocracy is, you know, the only way to keep the Iranian theocracy in power is to treat it the way Cheney and Bush treated it, right? Because that legitimates them, and then we're not going to let the U.S. push us around, you know. But if you just treat them like an ordinary country, there'll be big changes in Iran, because the social structures there is very, very much labile and very eager for fundamental change and amongst the younger people. So you have to treat the thing in a very much more dynamic way, in a larger, you know, transnational context. You can't treat it as, you know, one state in one country. It has to be in a regional and, of course, global pattern. And that's why, above all else, we have to fight for and organize for a more enlightened policy in this country, which begins, obviously, with weakening the grip that Zionism has on the U.S. state apparatus. Whoa, wouldn't that be a change worth fighting for? It's a good point. It's not, but I don't think you should regard the United American Jewish community as homogeneous, monolithic,
of course,
in this regard.
It's not. I'm talking about the leadership.
Well, this is the Zionist leadership. And so the key thing is to develop non-Zionist leadership within the American Jewish community. What's that? A post-Zionist, meta-Zionist. but all indicators show, and there's a very important finding that some social scientists did. They questioned American Jews, and they asked them fundamentally this question: would the disappearance of Israel as a Jewish state, I mean, not the disappearance of Israel, but the ceasing of Israel being a Jewish state, would that be perceived by you as an existential loss? In other words, something that really cut to the grain. And would you believe it, that this was very tightly correlated with age. And the older the Jewish respondent was, the more of a loss it would be seen. In a group over 60, it was like 67-70% would see it as a loss. From 40 to 60, it was like 55% would see it as a loss. Below 40, majority says, look, it wouldn't affect me that much. This is terribly important. You're seeing the younger generation of American Jews. Now, they're not willing to step out and become critical of Israel, be anti-Zionist, but they are by no means as hooked into it, despite everything that the Zionist organizations have done to give them free trips. And you know, any college student can get a free trip to Israel. It's very tempting. All these internships, there's so much money there. I mean, the Israeli lobbies are fantastically well-heeled and well-organized, and they go after it. But nonetheless, they are losing their grip on younger Jewish Americans. But, you know, the basic problem, this is a much larger question, is the destiny of the American Jewish community. why did the American Jewish community, which had always been extremely left-wing in its basic predilections, why did it turn so sharply to the right? That's a big question that one should ask. I mean, that's something that if you study the McCarthyite period and the HUAC, the House of American Un-American Activities, and the attacks on the film industry, they were constantly attacking them as Jews. There was a huge anti-Semitic theme that would be, and that culminated in the Rosenberg trial, in Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were executed. That was a show trial of Jewish loyalty. AIPAC, the centerpiece, the right-wing Jewish lobby, was founded in 1953, which is the year that Rosenberg was executed. Big turning point. But we have to understand that in much greater depth, because there's no question that the American Jewish community has, I think, lost its way, you know, really. But they're not, you know, there are a lot of young Jewish people and some older ones who are very restive with the Zionist consensus. And big turning point, and which is why Malton Mearsheimer wrote their book on the Israel lobby, has been the fact that the second Bush administration recruited all these Zionist neoconservatives to run the Iraq war. And there's such a very, very major input of Israel in the Iraq war. And as the Iraq war has been a disaster, that's made people question Israel. I think you have to say that if the occupation is ended in any kind of human way, any humanly decent way, it can only be ended by a radical demilitarization of Israel. Because, you know, Israeli policy is determined by its general staff and so on. So you have to, and that would require, you know, major shifts in U.S.-Israeli relations and so on. But I don't think you can end the occupation without profound shifts within Israel. Unless you propose to leave those 450,000 settlers in the middle of Palestine. No, you can't do that. You have to end the occupation in such a way that those illegal settlements are made history. That's not going to be easy either. But you're quite right. It's absolutely essential. And it's just essential, I think, as a transitional goal. It shouldn't be reified. You know, that's the answer, end the occupation. I think it's U.S. pro-Palestinian groups that sometimes choose that because it spares them the difficulties of thinking about fundamental transformations of Israel itself. And that's why it's important to talk about 48 rather than 67, although you have to talk about 67 also. Yeah, it was the band for a while.
You know, the more it seems to me there's a common theme here in terms of how important Israel is militarily, strategically, and the discussion just being attempted. Oh, and then Finkelstein right here.
It's hard to say whether this has actually been a crescendo because there's been so much of it over the years. It would require, you know, like a really, it's, you know, a very quantitative study, and how could you quantify something like that? Because it's been vicious for a long time, but I think it's more vicious, and I think it's more vicious in the sense that they sense that they're playing a losing hand now, that they don't have the power they used to. They have it. They still. It's odd because they still have the power of a Congress. They can still force, you know, Barack Obama to dance and sing their song, and you know they control the state, you know? But increasingly less and less they control civil society, and that's an interesting development in this country.
Universities?
Well, universities they fantastically control universities and the press. Yes, no question about it. Listen, you know, this book was banned by the University of Michigan press for a while, but we fought it. We fought it successfully. It's more and more possible to fight them because we have an organization, Committee for Open Discussion of Zionism, CODZ.org, where this is all detailed. Zin is one of our co-chairs, Richard Falk, who was Richard Falk was appointed by the UN to supervise what's going on in Palestine, and the Canadian government opposed him. Now, that's another thing you have to bear in mind. Even as they may be getting somewhat weaker in the U.S., they're stronger overseas. Sarkozy is practically a Zionist agent. I mean, it's incredible. Merkel is not a Zionist agent, but she's very plastic in the hands of the Zionists. There's huge inroads in the British Labour Party, for instance. It is a global thing. We're not talking about a conspiracy of the elders, but there's a global process to create sympathy and support for the state of Israel. But even as that happens, and to the extent that it happens, so do the peoples of the world react negatively. So in polls, after polls taken in the last year or so, Israel has been ranked as the most disliked country on earth, more than even the U.S., more than North Korea, and the like, and the greatest threat to world peace. I'm sorry, what? That's over and over again. But let me just say one last thing. If you want to make peace in this world, you've got to deal with Zionism, because the whole linchpin of the so-called war between civilizations, the fundamentalists and the Islam against the West, the new crusades, and blah, 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 blah. The linchpin of that takes place in Israel. Well, Jewish people have survived a really long time. And I think they've survived worse than this. But, I think, in my view, that if they don't solve the question of Zionism, that they will become increasingly marginalized. And they're always going to be there in any foreseeable future. But I think that there has to be an awakening on the part of Jews, and particularly Jewish Americans, that this has been a very bad time for them, even though it seemed to be a very powerful time, and that they made a big mistake. If you say it's a mistake, you can correct it. You know what I mean? It was a mistake. It becomes an evil when you stick to it, a mistake, but you don't have to. I do believe that the state of Israel will not last beyond mid-century. I can't see it. It's very artificial. It doesn't belong there. It's an artificially chosen state. It doesn't have an organic relationship to the territory, even though they have done a lot there. There's so much other instability in the region that it'll somehow be sacrificed to that. I can't imagine. I'm not good enough to imagine particular scenarios. But I do not see a very long history for the state of Israel as a Jewish state. I just don't. I think it'll evolve into a post-Zionist state within the next 20 years. That's my view. I think it's a member of the team, but they can be sloughed off. They're not the big player. I mean, the big players are in London and Tokyo and New York. That's who they've had. That's where finance capital is. Oh, it's very important, but there's always been opposition in the from various sectors of capital, because it's such a destabilizing factor. Capital craves stability. It also makes the conditions for stability impossible. So they're always they have their own conflict. The capitalists hate unpredictability and so on. Israel is still a bit player on the world stage, It only is important because the U.S. has chosen to make it its gendarme in the region. But that can change rather quickly. I just don't think that Israel is a big player in the world capitalist system as such. There are definite centers of capitalist power. Tel Aviv is not one of them. Well, it's not a coherent region at this point, because the interrelations between Israel and the Arab states are still so backwards. If that becomes what you might see, I'm not too happy about it. You might see happening what has happened in southern Africa as a whole, where you have South Africa being like the economic powerhouse of being a sub-imperialist power. Now, at this point, Israel is a sub-imperialist power, but only by virtue of its military aggressiveness and its claims, of expansion and the like. But South Africa, which is, the province of Gauteng, which is the one that has Johannesburg and, Pretoria in it, has an economic product that's equal to the rest of Africa combined. It's just vast. So they have a huge class. But Israel doesn't have that kind of status within the Middle East. Well, it can be made to serve a function, but the question is that once the imperialists in the U.S. decided that the function isn't worth it, they can cut it loose, and they will. They'll have to deal with the Zionist lobbies, but I submit the Zionist lobbies are weakening. I think, you know, within the lifetime of many people here, you're going to see major shifts in the configuration of Zionist power in this country. When you have the Forbes 400, you know, the 400 richest Americans, by various accounts, because nobody's done actual surveys, 40 or 50% of them are Jewish. Okay, you have a fantastic accumulation of wealth in Jewish hands. That is a fact. And a lot of that has been used for Zionist ends. You know, in my book, I deal with Chaim Saban, who's is by no means the richest Jew in America, but he's up there. And, you know, he basically bankrolls the Democratic Party. He has a tremendous power. But I don't see that power as organic. I mean, it can go on. Anybody who has money can go on, but it doesn't have to take that same ideological, you know, character. There can come a point in which the ruling powers of the United States simply say, this game is not worth the candle. We have sunk so much money into this state. It's made much more trouble than it's worth to us. And when that happens, you'll see changes. Up until that point, I do think that the Zionist lobby has inordinate power in this country. And I can give you endless examples of it. In Walton Mearsheimer's book, which I dislike in many ways, I'm in the process of reviewing it, I'll write a fairly harsh review, nonetheless makes many, many useful points. If you want to read empirical studies of the Zionist lobby, you know exactly what they've been able to do. And even that doesn't go far enough. My friend Jeff, you know who Jeff Blankford is? Jeff is in Northern California, lives in Ukiah now in San Francisco. He is in the process of writing his book on the Zionist lobby. When that book comes out, then you'll know what the Zionist lobby is all about, because Jeff Blankert knows it backwards and forwards better than anybody, much better than me. Well, first of all, it's not a very good haven for Jewish people, and you can do a lot better elsewhere. There's these shocking statistics, by the way, that came out last year, because the Holocaust survivors who are now living in Israel, a quarter of a million of them, more or less united to a man and woman in protest how they were being treated by the Jewish state. And guess which country they wanted to go back to?
Germany.
They felt the only place they could get decent care was in Germany. So, you know, it becomes pretty problematic. There's a lot of sort of curious and bizarre things you should always read. Lenny Brenner's book, Zionism in the Age of Dictators, which is being reissued this year, 1987. I have an introduction to a new edition. And what Brenner argues very convincingly is that the Zionists, despite what they're proclaiming, were always playing ball with the fascists. And with of the various fractions of the Jewish community, the Zionists were the weakest in terms of, you know, protesting against anti-Semitism and actually trying to protect Jews. They did a very poor job of it. And then there was a lot of shenanigans about Jewish refugees. You know, there was this very famous, infamous quote that Ben-Gurion made. This will be the last question, I guess. Ben-Gurion made this quote. I deal with it in my book. He said, he said this in 1934, I think, something like that. He said, if I had the choice between saving all of the children of Europe by sending them to various countries and only saving half of the children of Europe by sending them to Israel and no other country, I would save half of the children of Europe, which means I would allow half of the children of Europe to die, okay? And that is a sort of offhanded, wacky remark. But in fact, the Zionists did things like that. They actually, and there's a book which I cite, it's called In the Shadow of the Holocaust by a Pole named Jakub Grudzinski. They actually prevented several thousand Jewish orphans from the camps, the survivors, and this is, you know, in 46, from going to England, where homes had been provided for them within the very highly organized British Jewish community. They weren't going to go to, you know, impersonal orphanages. They were going to be under the care of English rabbis and Jewish charitable organizations, okay, of which there are many in England, you know, highly organized society. And they blocked it. Can you believe this? The Zionists blocked it. Why? Because they had to have only the Jews going, the Jews could only go to Israel. So it was that totalitarian view. There's a lot about that. In Grudzinski and in Brenner's book, I summarized some more of the evidence. So it's not really that there was such a neat haven. Publicity-wise, yes. I mean, a boat pulls up in Haifa with Jewish refugees. Everybody, is ecstatic. And of course, I mean, the Holocaust brought forth such emotional, toil and toll that, it's bound to have this profound effect. But as an authentic haven, no. And the final point I want to make, and we can just stop at this, because there's so much more to discuss, but I hope we got off to a good start here tonight. It was nice. Is which country on earth is the only one which is not safe to be Jewish? You don't have to reach to that one. There's only one country in this world where it doesn't pay to be Jewish.